only sentiment I want to express right now, when Israel is going through its own 9/11, is unequivocal support for the security and the right of Israel to defend itself.
It is important to remember, as we stand with Israel, as we stand against terror, as we mourn, that we learn the lessons of our own 9/11, which gave rise to hateful Muslim phobia and civil rights violations.
Our country has a responsibility, I believe, to call for a ceasefire and to call for the whole world to come together to try to stop the escalation of what is taking place in the Middle East.
Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Barbara Lee, all three Democratic members of Congress, are vying to become California's next U.S. senator. They spoke at a candidate forum earlier this month, the day after Hamas launched its attack on Israel. Until now, foreign policy hadn't been much of a factor in the race to succeed the late Dianne Feinstein, even though Feinstein was a major influence on foreign policy issues. Lee, Schiff, and Porter would all be very different senators when it comes to how they deal with America's allies and adversaries. That's according to my next guest. Cameron Joseph is a political reporter based in Washington, D.C., who wrote about this for the L.A. Times. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you on. Let's start with Congressman Adam Schiff. He spent years as the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Of the three, he's the only candidate to express unequivocal support for Israel. We heard that in the bite there. Has that support shifted, tempered at all, though, as we've seen the death toll climb in Gaza amid Israel's bombing campaign there?
It really hasn't. Obviously, he's expressed concern about Gaza civilians and Palestinians, but he's really emphasized that the U.S. needs to stand strong with Israel, give them the military aid that they need, and make it clear that there's no daylight between them diplomatically. And so that's a very different tone from especially what we've heard from Barbara Lee on some of these issues. And it really goes to a divide that we've seen in their views on foreign policy going back more than 20 years.
Right. And I want to get to Lee in a minute because there is a pretty stark divide between the two. But on Schiff's foreign policy record, you know, Schiff voted to authorize the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, though he later expressed regret for the latter. He also voted to support the Patriot Act, which vastly expanded the U.S. government's surveillance capabilities in the name of preventing terrorism. So how do you think that experience, his experience, has informed how he thinks about foreign policy today?
Well, he certainly comes from the more old school Democratic wing of the party that, you know, views interventionism, a more muscular approach to the world, as something that sometimes needs to happen. And he's been more willing to support U.S. interventions than Barbara Lee and then, frankly, a lot of other Democrats over the years. He came to regret his Iraq vote and has spoken pretty eloquently about how that ended up informing some of the reforms he's pushed while on the House Intelligence Committee to make it so that minority opinions do get through in terms of intelligence, so that it isn't a kind of a groupthink process. So this isn't completely black and white, and he's definitely made some efforts, both on the Patriot Act, which he voted for. He also pushed to limit some of its surveillance tools in a later reauthorization in a bipartisan effort. But, you know, it really has informed and directed how his career has gone. And I think it's important that most of the people who know Adam Schiff, especially nationally, know him from his impeachment efforts,
right,
and leading the first House impeachment. And it was very interesting to watch how familiar and comfortable he was on that. And that's largely because he'd spent a lot of time on foreign policy issues and looking at Ukraine, talking to experts on that, and knew some of the folks that he ended up having as witnesses for that impeachment effort as they unpacked the accusation that there had been a demand for a quid pro quo from President Trump in order to give Ukraine weapons to defend themselves against Russia. And so this really has informed and shaped him as a politician and as a policymaker. And so this is something that he really goes deep on. And, frankly, he's in some ways pretty similar to Dianne Feinstein in terms of the breadth and depth of knowledge,
right,
but also the part of the party that he comes from. But Dianne Feinstein voted for Iraq and never regretted it. And so I think he's probably the most similar to her of the three Democrats running for this seat. in terms of his views on these issues, but I think he's probably a little less interventionist than Feinstein was.
Well, and all of this contrasts with Barbara Lee. As you mentioned, she has the distinction of being the only member of Congress who opposed the authorization for use of military force after 9/11 that eventually led to the invasion of Iraq. She is calling for a ceasefire here, which, again, sort of puts her on the outskirts with the rest of the Democratic Party. That is not something you are hearing from the Biden administration.
Yeah, there's a clear divide in the Democratic Party right now on this, that some folks are kind of the traditional Democrats are very much, you know, we stand with Israel. We're not going to question Israel in this time of crisis. And then we see generally it's been more of a younger generation, but Lee is definitely a leader of the dovish wing of the Democratic Party, has been for a very long time. And we see polling that there's a pretty clear generational split on this. And Lee has not been quite as critical of Israel as some of her Democratic colleagues. We saw a bill that just moved through the House. It was a non-binding resolution basically saying, you know, this is entirely Hamas's fault. We stand with Israel. And while about close to a dozen Democrats ended up voting against that, Lee voted for it. So, and you know, she supported Israel funding for the Iron Dome for missile defense and defensive issues for Israel. So it's not like she's, you know, an anti-Israeli politician by any stretch. She's just more willing to criticize and more concerned about the actions of Israel and what this might mean for peace in the region, and all, especially for Palestinians and the Gazans who are caught in the middle of this right now.
And what about Katie Porter? You know, she does not have the decades of foreign policy experience, like the Lee and Schiff, who we just talked about. During that candidate forum, she responded by specifically calling out Iran. She said the U.S. has, quote, allowed terrorism to flourish and has refused to take a strong enough stance against Iran. Can you unpack that for a little bit? Because I think a lot of people found that maybe a little surprising.
Yeah, I was a little surprised to hear it myself, and some Democrats who, you know, are not don't have a dog in this fight. We're a little surprised to hear it, given her reputation in Congress as a very progressive member. Frankly, the rhetoric sounded a lot more like what some Republicans like Nikki Haley were saying in that moment than most Democrats. And I reached out to her team to kind of get a little more detail about what exactly she meant by that, and they pointed me back to the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, which I had a little trouble parsing exactly how her words squared with that, as you know, the one criticism of the U.S. not being more involved, you know, more hawkish folks on Iran who want to see the U.S. Take a more tougher approach to Iran. You were almost unanimously opposed to that deal, so it's I'm still curious exactly what her views are. She's been very outspoken as a critic of Iran over the last few years, especially since they started, the Iranian regime cracked down on its own citizens and the protesters in the last year or so. And she's been very outspoken. There's a large Iranian American population in her district in Orange County. But she hasn't been as outspoken on the kind of foreign aspect of Iranian intervention and their funding of groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. So, I think, look, she's only been in Congress a few terms, and she has not, she's very smart and has developed expertise in other areas. She has not spent a ton of time talking about and working on foreign policy compared to the other two. And so that's,
I want to jump in here really quick because we only have about 15, 20 seconds left. But how do you see this shaping the race? I mean, these are three Democrats. There is not a lot of daylight between the three of them in terms of their policies, except on this issue. So could this really become a something that will have voters choose to go one way or the other based on where they stand on this issue?
I think it absolutely could for certain voters who care a lot about this issue. Foreign policy tends to recede once it recedes from the headlines. So we'll see what it looks like in a couple months if people are still talking about this.
All right. Cameron Joseph, he's a political reporter based in Washington, D.C., and he wrote about how this is shaping the race to be the next U.S. senator in California. Cameron, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new lawsuit tests whether copyright protections on song lyrics could rein in generative AI. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Artificial intelligence may pose a threat to the livelihood of artists, performers, and writers, especially if those AI bots are trained on copyrighted works. So far, it's been hard to prove AI copyright infringement in court, but one creative form might be primed to do that more easily than others. Song lyrics. Last week, major record companies like Universal Music Group sued an AI startup called Anthropic for training their bot, Claude 2, on copyrighted song lyrics. Amelia David covers AI for The Verge, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
So the complaint mentions an example that when the AI had been prompted to, quote, write a song about the death of Buddy Holly, they got kind of an interesting result. What does the complaint allege happen?
Sure. So the complaint basically said that if you prompt the AI using those same exact words, it came out with the exact lyrics of American Pie, which does talk about the death of Buddy Holly.
Right. And my understanding is you tried this too. Is that what happened? Did you get the same result?
Actually, I did it two different ways. The first time I did it, I said, tell me about the history of Buddy Holly, and it gave me different lyrics, gave me a completely different song. But when I tried the exact same prompt that the lawsuit alleges that they used, write me a song about the death of Buddy Holly, it gave me one of the more famous parts or verses of that song. Some words were different in the other parts of the song, but generally, the gist and the language and the same exact verbiage, verses even, were the same. And it was exactly the same as it was laid out in the lawsuit.
So this company Anthropic, I admittedly haven't heard much about them, but they are a pretty, you know, big player in the AI space, a rival to companies like OpenAI, makers of ChatGPT. Can you tell us more about them and their generative AI, Claude 2?
Anthropic creates large language models like OpenAI does, and their version of ChatGPT is called Claude. And what's interesting about Anthropic is that they've attracted a lot of very big investors, Google and Amazon. In fact, Amazon put in about $4 billion.
Wow.
They bill themselves as a more responsible creator of generative AI platforms. They have something called constitutional AI. They have a set of principles and guidelines that they tend to follow when they're creating their products before they send it out into the world.
So these music companies allege that what Anthropic is doing, though, is a violation of copyright. Why might they potentially have an easier time proving that than some of these other lawsuits that we've seen against other generative AI lawsuits brought by novelists like George R.R. Martin, John Grisham? Why could song lyrics be kind of a game changer in the legal space?
This is something that I didn't know before writing about the lawsuit. When you search for song lyrics on the internet, when you Google like lyrics for American Pie or another song that was mentioned in the lawsuit, which was Katy Perry's Roar.
Or any song, really, right? How many of us have, you know, been like, oh, what's the lyrics to this song that I really like, right?
Exactly. And when you do that, you do get a result either from Google itself, or you could do it through other marketplaces like companies like Genius and Music Match. But if you scroll down further as you look at the song, you'll see that there's words underneath the lyrics that say, this song is owned by, say, Universal Music Group, which is suing Anthropic. So these websites, including Google, have asked for permission to distribute these lyrics. And The lawsuit alleges that Anthropic, through Claude, doesn't provide that disclaimer that these lyrics are owned by someone else. The difference with the song lyrics compared to, say, Game of Thrones is that, one, the authors are alleging that their work was taken in by these by AI companies to train their models without their permission. And two, that if you ask their AI platforms, those chatbots, they will spit out words that are kind of similar to what Game of Thrones sounds like. It's harder to prove something sounds similar. It's also harder to prove that copyrighted material was taken without permission and not with what's called a fair use agreement, than say song lyrics that you did search for. It did release the exact same lyrics, but it doesn't say who owns it. And there's no way to know that these are copyrighted text.
So it sounds like the companies don't necessarily, and correct me if I'm wrong here, it sounds like the companies don't necessarily have a problem with Claude 2 generating kind of word for word lyrics on songs that they own. They just want it to be shown that that's copyrighted material somewhere. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that what the record labels want first and foremost is the acknowledgement that, yes, their rights were infringed, and two, that if Claude is going to keep distributing these lyrics, then they should have an agreement which includes a monetary part of it, like they pay to distribute those lyrics.
Amelia David covers AI for The Verge. Amelia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, rapper Chuck D is best known as the frontman for the group Public Enemy. But when the pandemic hit a few years ago, he picked up his pen and started drawing images that he saw on the news.
We have calamity, drama, and trauma always floating to the top of the news, and peace, love, and understanding is something that never really gets talked about, passed around as easily.
Chuck D is here to talk about his new graphic novel, Summer of Ham. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy, in for Madeline Brand. As hip-hop celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, rapper Chuck D has become a kind of elder statesman of the genre. In the mid-80s, his group Public Enemy helped bring a socially conscious edge to hip-hop with their explicit criticism of politics and racism in America, most famously on the song Fight the Power. Well, Public Enemy has since released 15 studio albums, earned a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, and been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. All the while, Chuck D has remained active in various political causes like Rock the Vote, ending mass incarceration. He co-founded the Hip Hop Alliance to organize for the labor rights of hip hop and R&B musicians. And now he's published a series of graphic novels, or naphic grovels, as he calls them, under a new publishing imprint called Enemy Books. The most recent one was released earlier this summer. It's called The Summer of Ham, about the summer of 2022. And Chuck D joins me now to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michelle, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
I'm glad I could talk about this in the blizzard of things that we're both doing. So
yeah, you've got the laundry list of things going on right now, it seems.
Laundry and the dry list.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ham, the Summer of Ham, Ham is an acronym. It stands for Hollow Pointlessness Aiding Mass Nihilism. Can you unpack that sentiment for us a little bit? Where does that come from?
Not only am I trying to be a wordsmith, but you know, I have License to Ill, as they say, the great Beastie Boy titled album from 1986, which means that sometimes we can take vernacular and flip it and turn it around. And ham is, it was never such a word as ham, but we've heard in a saying, let's go ham or something going ham on you, which is hard as a mug, you know. But I decided to say, if I'm going to actually put together a Naphic grovel, not only am I making up the term Naphic grovel, but also I'm actually making some words kind of fit the terms that I kind of create, as well alongside the illustrations that I've done inside my Naphic grovels as well, which a day-to-day journal depicting what was on the screens that we see and what's surrounding our daily life. And in 2022, no year was ever more prevalent, if you paid attention to it, than the asphyxiation in the United States of America and abroad on guns.
Yeah. What about the summer of 22 triggered the level of bleak sentiment that comes with a hollow pointlessness and mass nihilism? I mean, because 2022, you know, especially after 2021, 2020, I mean, right, it's been a series of bleak years. So I guess what for you set that year apart?
2022 is that first year that everybody's so-called freedom to go wherever they want and do whatever they want and breathe wherever they wanted to, mm-hmm, mask or no mask, was bestowed once again on the international public as well, you know, domestic. People didn't know how to act. People were tight. I don't think a lot of people have gotten that therapeutic, the therapy to basically be a response, right, of what they went through.
No one's doing well is the phrase. Yeah.
Yes, Michelle. It all acted out. And I just kept a day-to-day journal about what was coming through the news and whatnot. And I did illustrations alongside of it, which is actually what a Naphic grovel means to me. And it was my fourth book of the year, because the first three books I did were Akashic books. It's called Studio.
Right.
And it actually talked about 2020, 2021, and the latter part of 2021 going into 2022. So this was just the latest in a chapter of reflections of what I've seen and put it in the illustrative mode, because I have a background in a degree in the Delphi University in 1984. I was in the arts very thoroughly. And what we've seen in 2023 is maybe less in the media, which is as dangerous because there's a desensitivity to the bloodshed that's still going on now. And now we got like a war, you know, internationally. So this has all come full circle in the things I like to at least discuss publicly, but now illustratively.
Can you describe your artistic process in your style? Because your drawings, there's this very frenetic, raw energy to them. And, you know, as looking through them, I felt very, you know, both very taken in by them, but also really unsettled. What's your style? What's your starting point?
My starting point is the energy of it. And I think, if anything, I could probably tip my hat to, after my dad passed in 2016, I did only two ayahuasca journey visits. And the second one I did with a community, and I just said, hey, I just want to get a ream of paper and see what comes out of it, you know, because I actually got the answers. I did it my first time solo with a shaman friend.
Not going to lie, not the answer I was expecting you to.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, that's why we're talking. So that was like actually to find out where my dad's spirit was, and that was done. I didn't have to necessarily frequent it. But the second time I did it with community, and I said, okay, what the hell? Let me get a ream of paper and try to draw what I'm experiencing. And I did 70 illustrations in 4 hours. But basically, I was told, like, I have no scar tissue within, and I've always been able to elevate it up and down inside of myself with no aid. So, you know, long story short, Michelle, you know, out of it came 70 illustrations in 4 hours. But the illustrations came from the energy outward. And as an illustrator, a painter, artist, you know, a lot of people always do from contour inward. So this style, as you know, has been depicted just in going alongside the style I had all along, is that draw with energy and do it with what I call courtroom speed.
Yeah, there's like a courtroom. Like I was trying to describe, trying to figure out a way to describe the art in your Naphic Grovel, and it was some sort of combination of like a courtroom sketch meets graffiti. These are pictures of kind of traumatizing events in culture.
Yeah. You know, my tools are rudimentary. It was not like go to the best art store and pick up the best art supplies. It's like whiteout, Sharpie, marker, watercolor paints, some good, some bad, and color pencils, and just let my spirit roam into the illustration. But really, more importantly, Michelle, is that as we move further into technology and AI becoming the domineering wow factor, the whole beauty, I think, and some of Ham and some of my Naphic Grovels is the enjoyment of embracing your mistakes. And I think a lot of people, when they go to the arts, it's about trying to perfect something. And this actually was in reverse.
You mentioned gun violence before, and there's a particular focus on that in this book, Summer of Ham. And one of the sketches has this kind of banner above it that says the disunited states of America, and underneath it, guns, guns, guns. There's a lot of faces. I mean, I can see President Trump. I see the Capitol building in the background. I see what I think are the Supreme Court justices. Can you describe this image a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, it's a medley, you know, a medley of a bunch of different things going on. It's like incarceration, the government with the audacity to tell women what to do with their bodies, so the abortion, and then also in the front, you got the Supreme Court in front of three women or four women who are basically down to their skivvies. And, you know, and so that's in there. And then you just got, you know, just, I call them ammosexuals who just can't live without their gun. And I think on top of Trump's hair in front of the Washington Monument, you have, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. So it's basically what comes to mind and what you can do to stun people when they look at art. So this isn't trying to make perfect art. This was trying to really seriously illustrate what I feel at the moment.
Yeah, but I think that feeling is contagious. Like looking at this, I feel this too. And there's a lot of power in these images.
You know, well, I like the mode of instead of sitting and making a 8-foot by 10-foot piece, like this is like 1695, you know, the year. I really appreciate the scanning, the manipulation sometimes, and the and just the magnitude that printing offers, and the fact that you could now scan and print something to the size of a building, or even project it to the size of a building, or put it on a gigantic screen, to me is really the measurement of the elements that make hip hop in the first place, which is sight, sound, story, and style. This is the way we listen to music. This is the way we watch films. This is the way we even read now. It's everything's intertwined, and everybody's a screen agent, Michelle.
Well, you're renowned for your socially conscious lyrics in hip-hop, and in the era, though, of social media and artificial intelligence and the kind of ephemeral nature of art, or quote-unquote content, which people keep calling it, how do you think the relationship between political activism and music has changed since Public Enemy, you know, came on the scene in the mid-80s?
We have to be wary of the tail wagging the dog, because before, the machine was raged against. Now, when they pretty much have the machine is the only way that you're going to be able to hear an artist from being a startup artist that wants to do it, and somebody who's at a record company or a label or whatever that is right now, it's all been like kind of evened out. But it's going to be based on who do you see more, who do you hear more, and you just want to be able to let artists know that just don't take the easy route just to get attention. Attention is the cheapest price to pay, but now we have Calamity, Drama, and Trauma always floating to the top of the news, and peace, love, and understanding is something that never really gets talked about or passed around as easily. So we have to reinforce that in our artistry, is that we should be 360 degrees instead of just one dimensional.
When you say taking the easy way out, what do you mean by that?
The easy way out is to get some attention by coming up with something that's ostentatious or dramatic. Some negative energy is always going to get people to turn around, but positive energy is taken for granted to these days. Well-balanced diet is what we need, whether you're eating some food, especially in the United States, or you're taking in data and information and misinformation. How much are you consuming from a screen? So I think the book issues with that. And also, I think my other works also talk to that as well. But, you know, now, of course, a lot of this was also developed out of the fact that we kind of like have been dancing with social media for more than a decade now, 15 years in many cases. Does it dictate us or do we dictate it? So I would do a lot of catchy things on social media, and my art found a life on social media because I could do it fast, comment on something and upload it real quick. Like they used to say, a picture's worth 1,000 words, but now images online are worth 10,000 words. So that's where the books come from.
You know, as somebody who's been very politically active all their life, how do you handle criticism and pushback in this era of social media when speaking out can really become a cultural lightning rod?
Well, you got to know who you are. I'm a little unfair on how I deal with it because I'm from last century, Michelle. So therefore, I have the, you know, GTFOH in me to tell anything that comes out of me, at me, I should say, to GTFOH. But today, everybody's a stranger until they become a friend. So when you go into social media, everybody's a stranger. So you got to know who you are. So that is the number one golden rule in the creating. I create, I'm a furnace. I really don't account. I don't count how many books I'm going to sell, how much money I'm going to make. I'm a creator. I don't go about this with any kind of assurance other than I create art to satisfy me. The only time I have to satisfy the audience is those that are on the same line of appreciating my art where I have to do a performance. So it's really kind of like uncompromising when it comes down, because I don't care who like it or who don't. But that's not the ways of this century. People are looking for affirmation when it comes down to like, oh, you know, please like my work or whatever. But I come from the century where if you looked in the mirror, you don't go outside and ask people how you look.
All right. Well, Chuck D, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you. And the fact that you're having a conversation with me about it is something that I don't hold lightly and I don't take for granted. So thank you, Michelle.
That's Chuck D, frontman for the hip hop group Public Enemy, artist, activist, and author. The name of his graphic novel is Summer of Ham, Hollow Pointlessness Aiding Mass Nihilism.
Yeah, some of y'all flipped like Wilson and forgot. Yeah, Chuck. What we're gonna do right here is go back. Way back. Back into rhyme.
Coming up on Press Play, we'll have your weekend film reviews. That's next on Press Play. This is KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy, in for Madeline Brand this week, and it's time for film reviews with expert advice on what to see and what to skip. Joining us today are Sean Edwards, a film critic at Fox 4 News in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. And Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast Unspooled and film reviewer for The New York Times. Hi, Amy.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
All right, let's start with Five Nights at Freddy's. This is based on the indie horror video game of the same name.
In the 80s, kids went missing. The police searched Freddy's top to bottom. Hello? They never found them. That's why the place shut down.
There are ghost children possessing giant robots. Thanks for the heads up.
Technically, they're animatronics.
All right, it is Halloween weekend indeed. Amy, the game franchise first came out in 2014 and quickly built a pretty big cult following. The game centers around this night security guard officer at a kind of Chuck E. Cheese-like pizza chain situation. How close is the plot in this film? How close does it hew to the source material in the video game?
I mean, I assume fairly close. This is one of those films where it feels a lot smarter than you expect it to feel, and then it absolutely falls apart when you bother trying to analyze what's happening on the screen at all. I mean, like, as you heard, yes, this is about a Chuck E. Cheese analog where the animatronics are now filled with the spirits of tragic ghost children. And I have to kind of say right up at the top, that's weirdly not that different from the true corporate origin story of the character Chuck E. Cheese, which I just have to say this really quick. It's my fulfilled lifelong dream of telling this to people. That
the floor Chuck is yours, Cheese. Amy.
Oh, thank you. His real full name is Charles Entertainment Cheese. And also, he is an orphan who grew up in an orphanage called St. Marinara's. And Chuck E. Cheese does not know his parents, and he does not know his real birthday. And that is why, as an adult mouse, he lives at a pizza place where he can celebrate birthdays every day.
That's horrifying.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But so this movie itself, the way that it's kind of cast is super confusing. Josh Hutcherson is the security guard. He's in charge of a little girl at home. You think this is his daughter. She turns out to be his sister. The ages are so weird in this movie. But this movie, I will say, it is a cut above a slasher. I was expecting a slasher. This is more complex. I would say, like, narratively too complex. The more complex you think the story is, kind of the dumber it becomes. Like, everything in this movie does not hold up as soon as the movie is over, but it's fine from scene to scene as you're going along.
Sean, the animatronic creatures here, they were created by Jim Henson's Creature Shop. Can you talk about the aesthetics of the film and broadly what you thought? Were they creepy?
Well, first off, I agree with Amy on a lot of what she said. And yes, the animatronics are creepy, but they're not creepy because of the film. They're just creepy in real life. So there's not a lot of credit for the filmmakers in making the animatronics creepy, which I was sort of disappointed. I mean, if you're going to put animatronics and sort of make them the villain of a horror movie, go over the top with it, you know, make them more creepy than what you can actually get at a real life Chuck E. Cheese. And they didn't really accomplish that. And I did think that the narrative was a bit all over the place. I mean, there were some good points to the storytelling. And as Amy mentioned, there were some really confusing points to the storytelling that I didn't really understand how it all fit together. My biggest problem was this film sort of plays against brand. Like, Blumhouse is known for like movies like Paranormal Activity, The Purge, Insidious, and Get Out. And this didn't really play like that. It's less of a horror film and more of a thriller, because I mean, the jump scares are lame. The creepiness factor really didn't work. And it's actually fitting that Matthew Lillard stars in this movie, because it actually plays like an episode of Scooby-Doo.
All right. So if you're looking for some Halloween frights, this one, maybe not it. Five Nights at Freddy's is in theaters and wide release. Okay. Up next, we have a satire about Big Pharma. This is Pain Hustlers, and it stars Emily Blunt and Chris Evans.
Get a doctor to prescribe your drug. You know, we bill on a full dose script.
What?
40 grand.
A year?
A month. It's a long odds lottery ticket buried under 1,000 rejections. And you gotta have the grit to reach down and scratch it.
There's nothing so inspiring as sheer desperation.
All right, Sean, Blunt plays a single mom who works at a strip club. That's where she meets a pharmaceutical rep played by Chris Evans, who lures her into working with him with the promise of a bigger paycheck and a better life. What did you think of this?
Well, if movies were sold at McDonald's, this is the type of film people would buy on the regular, because it's very generic. It's easy to digest, and it really doesn't take a lot to understand what's going on. But that's not this film's biggest problem. This film's biggest problem is really, really late to the party. Like, there have been so many movies and TV series and documentaries that have explored and examined the opioid crisis in America, to where this is sort of like really, really traveling down a road that many times has been traveled before. Like, this has been covered to death. And they do nothing new with this material. The problem is, it's directed by David Yates, who is, you know, mostly known for brilliantly directing the latter half of the Harry Potter film saga, but there's no magic here at all. And it also seems that someone slipped him the Aaron Brockovich playbook, because is you know, Emily Blunt, is as much as she tries to elevate this material, she just can't, because she doesn't have anything to work with. I mean, every character in this movie is stereotypical. Every plot device is stereotypical. I mean, and it's all by the numbers, but nothing adds up, because this sort of material has been covered by way better series like Dope Sick and Painkillers, and way better movies like Recovery Boys, and way better documentaries that had really, really tackled this really devastating ordeal and done it much better. But with all that said, for some reason, it's a very entertaining movie. It just doesn't shed any new light on the opiate crisis, and it's just not very good. But for some reason, it's watchable.
Yeah, Amy, what did you think? Because watching this, I got the trailer, I got very much like Wolf of Wall Street vibes, kind of tongue-in-cheek take on this extremely real crisis that is unfolding still in a lot of ways. And do you agree with Sean that other series kind of tackle this better?
I haven't seen most of the ones he's mentioning, and I probably should, because I enjoyed this watch a lot. I mean, it is based on the true story of a company called like Incest Therapeutics, whose founder, who's kind of the Andy Garcia analog in here, he went to jail as well as several other employees for the crimes we see in this movie and then other crimes that happened that this movie didn't even cover because there's just so much happening in here. Yeah, in this like post-Wolf of Wall Street era, we have had these movies on brand, you know, Blackberry and Beanie Babies just this year. And I always like these movies because they tend to be about how low people will sink to make a buck, you know, like how capitalism cheapens everybody. All of these like employees are like saying, we're doing what is right and mostly legal. You know, it's legal up until you get caught. And, you know, the best parts of these movies are always those scenes of like greed and excess, which I think Wolf of Wall Street really just set the standard here. And this film kind of chases after it. But this particular story is so much harder to tonally pull off because people died. People are still dying. And I think the director, David Yates, has a real conscience about that. And he's trying his best, especially in the second part of the film, to kind of balance the fun with the horror. But that is a really hard sell. So yes, I find this film very, very, very entertaining, but you can see the pain inside of it, kind of struggling to even figure out how to tell this story in a way that people will watch and also be horrified.
All right, Pain Hustlers is in select theaters and streaming on Netflix beginning tomorrow. Next, we have The Holdovers from Academy Award-winning director Alexander Payne, teaming up again with his Sideways star Paul Giamatti here. Giamatti is still cranky, but he's playing a teacher at a New England boarding school.
Mr. Hunnam.
Hello, Mary.
I heard you got stuck with babysitting duty this year. How'd you manage that?
That's another detention!
Do you think I want to be babysitting you? No, I was praying your mother would pick up the phone, or your father would arrive in a helicopter or a flying saucer.
My father's dead.
Amy, this film is set in the early 70s in the Vietnam era. These holdover students have to stay behind at school during the holiday break. And of course, someone needs to watch them. So tell us about that lucky teacher Giamatti plays.
Yeah, Giamatti is playing the history teacher, who's definitely the least popular teacher at the entire school with the students and the faculty. He's one of those guys who cannot help relating everything to Icarus, and people just blanket him. And he's like, okay. And he soldiers on. And, you know, he gets into this like central relationship with one of the kids who stuck there for the holidays. This kid played by Dominic Sessa, who's like also super smart and also kind of a social idiot, the way they both really are. And I appreciate that, like, Alex Payne doesn't cheat how the connection between these two men deepen. Like, it's really natural, which means they're never going to fully spill their guts to each other. They're never going to go for that big moment of trying to make the audience cry, which I really respect. You know, this film starts off kind of brash and goofy, and then it settles down into the things it wants to talk about: privilege and failure and education and complacency and making assumptions about people. And, you know, they're joined by a third person, one of the chefs played by Divine Joy Randolph, who we heard in that clip. This just film is just very classic and steady. It's really, really easy to like. It's got a good dash of bitters to it, but it's hard to fall in love with this film. It's just incredibly solid.
All right, Sean, speaking of classic, I understand that Payne wanted this movie to not just feel like the movie was set in the 1970s, but to really feel like you were watching a movie made in the 70s. Does that help or hurt the film?
I thought it helped because he executed that very well from the opening credit sequence to the end of the film. Yes, it drips of the 70s. It feels like the 70s. It looked like the 70s and it sounded like the 70s. And the performances were true to that era. I mean, to me, it was a fascinating movie about heartbreak, grief, loneliness, isolation, privilege, trauma, and mental health. And yeah, Paul Giamatti, he's always terrific. But the standout for me was Divine Joy Randolph, because she actually took and elevated a character that could have easily been one note and totally derailed the entire film. And kudos to Dominic Sessa, because this is his feature film debut and he holds his own with Giamatti and Randolph very well. And just the back and forth between those three, that's the selling point of the movie. But no, Alexander Payne does a terrific job in delivering a sort of melancholy holiday classic that worked on a lot of levels.
All right, The Holdovers is in select LA theaters beginning tomorrow and in wide release beginning November 10th. Last up, a science fiction romance called Fingernails, directed by Greek filmmaker Christos Nikou. This stars Riz Ahmed and Jesse Buckley as workers at a compatibility testing facility called the Love Institute.
A lot of famous people study there.
Really? Like who?
Ginger Spice.
She's my favorite.
I know.
The truth is, we're all achingly lonely, and we're endlessly searching for ways to fill that void.
Let me ask you something. Why do you work at the Institute?
Maybe you understand love a little better.
All right, Sean, at the center of this is a new technology that's supposed to prove whether a couple is truly in love. What could go wrong?
Well, actually, a lot can go wrong. But the thing that went wrong with me with this film, Fingernails, is that, yeah, it is about this technology that sort of tests whether or not you're compatible with the person that you love. And the thing that frustrated me the most is I wanted to know more about this technology. I wanted to know how they came up with it, how it actually worked. And they really don't explore that. But what they do very well is they do sort of do this sort of like different take and different examination on relationships. But the way it's all pulled together and the way that it works is really on the performances delivered by Jesse Buckley and Riz Ahmed and Jeremy Allen White, best known from The Bear. I thought it was nuanced. It was realistic. But the problem is it may be all a bit too quiet and a bit too slow. And it was just a lot unexplained when you have to talk about their relationships in relation to this institute. And not a lot of that is tied together in the film. So as much as I love the film, I was frustrated with the film.
Amy, what did you think?
Yeah, this film starts so strong. I mean, the Greek filmmakers really kind of own this tone of like lightly sci-fi anthropological drama.
Yeah, it has Yorgos Lanthimos vibes to it for sure.
Exactly. You can tell he's like a huge influence here. And the problem is they're also doing sort of that Yorgos Lanthimos style acting where like Riz Ahmed and Jesse Buckley are kind of being very neutral and very formal and kind of repressed. And that carries you through a lot of the story. And then in the third act, it becomes really monotonous, you know, because they're just staying in that tone and the film kind of starts to feel like it's really spinning its wheels. And kind of to Sean's point, one thing that this film cannot decide, it just doesn't want to seem to decide, is like, is this love test, which involves ripping off your fingernails, that's the title of the film, is ripping off your fingernails a real genuine test that proves that you're in love, or is this bunk and everybody is believing wholeheartedly in a test that maybe is flawed? And the film itself kind of ironically doesn't want to commit one way or another, and that becomes part of the struggle. But the first two thirds of this, so smart, so funny, really, really, really engaging that you want to see it at least for those.
All right, Fingernails is in select theaters tomorrow and coming to Apple TV Plus on November 3rd. And that does it for this week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sean Edwards is a film critic at Fox 4 News in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. And Amy Nicholson is host of the podcast Unspooled and film reviewer for The New York Times. Does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Bennett Purser, Nihar Patel, and Sarah Singer Schiff. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. And our technical director is Mario Saavedra. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Michelle Aloy. It's been a pleasure being with you all week. Madeline Brand is back with you on Monday.